The Secrets of Middle-Earth is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give.
You're listening to The Secrets of Middle-Earth, where we discuss the hidden themes and deeper layers found in the works of J.R.R. Tolkien, whether in his writings or in any of the media derived from them. I'm Jeff Hecker, and joining me today on the panel are Alex Murray. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Jeff.
And Thomas Salerno. Hey, Thomas.
Hey there, Jeff.
And be sure to follow The Secrets of Middle-Earth in Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, which is being discontinued probably by the time this comes out, and transferred to YouTube Music in April, so make sure you've made that switch if you use that, Spotify, or any other podcast directory or app. And find us on social media at facebook.com/StarQuestMedia. Or on Twitter, where we are at SQPN, or on Instagram, we were at StarQuest Network. And don't forget, you can get your own official Secrets of Middle-Earth merch, including our awesome t-shirt, at sqpn.com/merch. And it's a great way for you to support the show and show your love for Tolkien and his wonderful world of Middle-Earth. And before we get into today's topic, I didn't know if there was any rings of power news to we wanted to cover. The only note I saw was that the creators have signed a deal to stay with Amazon. So it sounds like there's, even though season 3 isn't officially renewed, it sounds like there's probably going to be renewed if they're staying on with Amazon. But I didn't know if either of you had heard anything on Rings of Power lately or any other news of in Middle Earth.
That kind of tells me that they've at least, like, the suits have at least seen like a rough cut of season 2 or something, and they're probably like, yeah, okay. So
yeah, I recall, do you know what, I confess, I haven't seen a lot of Rings of Power, but I did remember reading something just the other day about it. Maybe it's what you're saying, Jeff, about possibly a season 3, but we'll see. I think I'll give season 2 a try, you know. I'll give it a go.
Yeah, I think we overall liked the first season. It was not perfect, but, and, you know, had some silly things in it, but I enjoyed it overall.
You're a generous man. I'm like one of those bitter, hardcore Loader fans. Yeah. No, I'll give it a go. Any opportunity to visit Middle Earth, and I'm up for a visit.
All right. Well, hopefully today's topic will be more in your wheelhouse. So today we are talking about Peter Jackson's Return of the King to finish the trilogy. So just kind of a summary, and it's not going to be brief just because we're discussing there's so much that happens. So Frodo and Sam, along with Gollum, make their way into Mordor. Gollum tricks Frodo into sending Sam away before bringing him to the spider Shelob so he can get the precious. Frodo is stung and paralyzed by Shelob and taken by orcs, but Sam returns. He rescues Frodo, and they travel to Mount Doom. And that goes through a lot of the movie, but then it's intercut with this next part, which is what everybody else is doing. Meanwhile, the rest of the Fellowship is reunited. While in Rohan, Pippin causes trouble by looking into Saruman's Palantir, which causes Sauron to begin looking for a hobbit. As a ruse to draw Sauron's eye, Gandalf takes Pippin to Minas Tirith, and Pippin joins the service of Denethor, steward of Gondor, in repayment for Boromir's death. Denethor refuses to call for aid while Mordor is preparing to march on Gondor, but Gandalf has Pippin light the beacons to call for aid from Rohan. Gandalf also saves Faramir, Denethor's other son, and his men by driving off a Nazgul while they retreat from Osgiliath across the river. Rohan answers the call, and Théoden and his forces begin the ride to Minas Tirith. Along the way, fearing Arwen's death in a land ruled by Sauron, Elrond visits Aragorn with the gift, the reforged sword of Elendil, with the advice of bringing the ghostly Oathbreakers of Dunharrow into battle to save Gondor. With Legolas and Gimli, he travels into the mountain and gains their temporary allegiance of the Oathbreakers. In the meantime, to please his father, Faramir leads a doomed attempt to recapture Osgiliath. This fails, and Faramir is sent back barely alive, and Mordor begins to siege Minas Tirith. Denethor tries to burn himself and Faramir, but Pippin saves Faramir. The Rohirrim arrives to Minas Tirith, but they face defeat at the overwhelming forces of Sauron and the Haradrim, the men from the east. Théoden is mortally wounded, but not before Éowyn slays the Witch King, while the Oathkeepers arrive to defeat the enemy, and Aragorn releases them. To give Frodo time, Aragorn reveals himself to Sauron and marches with the men of Gondor and Rohan on the Black Gate. They attack Mordor in a final offensive. Frodo and Sam arrive at Mount Doom, but are confronted by Gollum. In the end, Frodo refuses to destroy the ring, but Gollum bites his finger off, takes the ring, and falls in. The ring is destroyed, the forces of Mordor retreat, and the Fellowship all lives and is reunited. And in one of many endings, Aragorn is crowned king and marries Arwen, or it's implied that they marry. It's also implied that Éomer will become king of Rohan and Faramir marries Éowyn. The hobbits return to the unscoured Shire and Sam marries Rosie. And in a final journey, Gandalf, Elrond, Galadriel, Bilbo, and Frodo set sail for the west, while Sam and Pippin and Merry return home. And Sam returns home to his family and lives happily ever after. So that's about as brief of a summary of a 4-hour movie I could do. So.
Yeah, exactly.
So what did you all think of this one? I know it's been out for over 20 years at this point, just like the other ones. But Alex, I'll let you go first. What were your thoughts on this, both new and old?
Well, do you know, it's interesting. So I literally finished watching it this afternoon. So for me, it's kind of talking about this is kind of like, you know, a slice of warm, freshly baked bread with nice butter melted on it. So I can't wait to talk about this. I absolutely love it. I loved it the first time I saw it. How can you love Lord of the Rings less as time goes on? I don't know if that's possible. You just love it more. And watching it, so now we're recording this and we're in the middle of Lent, and it occurred to me today when I was watching it, what kept coming up to me, especially coming to my mind, especially as Frodo and Sam get closer and closer to Mordo, but even from the beginning, was the Stations of the Cross. So just to think about that and kind of have those juxtaposed. I mean, I know Tolkien probably would hate this, if, you know, hear me say this, but it was a really good, both things came into my mind, I think, because this is the Lenten season. And, but I think it's a fantastic movie. There are, some weak points, but the weak points in these films would be high points in even really good quality films. You know, some can't get enough of it. What can I say?
Yeah, for sure. I don't know how many times I've seen it at this point. I at least am watching it once a year, if not more, because when we did the Two Towers a little while ago, I was like, oh, I guess I need to watch Return of the King. And then I just watched Return of the King again for the purposes of this recording. So, yeah, definitely it's one. I can agree. It gets better every time I watch it. And just I've never done like the full day of starting and with Fellowship in the morning and watching all the way through Return of the King all in one day. But one of these days I want to do that. But
you have to be an old pro to do that, Jeff. I've done it.
Or have young kids that won't bother me that's while I'm true. Trying to watch.
Yeah, that's true. No, actually, the one time I did it, I was really sick, and my being sick was my excuse.
Yeah.
Like, I don't have anything else. I'm too weak to do anything else but fight a battle in Middle Earth.
Yeah. What about you, Thomas?
Well, I actually have very fond memories of the theater experience for this one, because my wonderful late aunt brought my brother and I to see this movie. And this was during a period where for some reason we were always going to movies with my aunt. She would be I guess my parents were busy, but she would always be the one to take us to the movies. And I remember she really liked this movie. So we had a lot of fun together. And it's not like she was even a huge like Tolkien fan. She knew of my interest in it and my brother's interest in it. And she always gave me like Lord of the Rings related gifts and stuff. But yeah, I remember just the theater experience. It's one of those, you know, when I remember my aunt, you know, sadly, she passed on a few years ago. But when I remember her, this is one of the memories that sticks out, is going to see the Return of the King. And sitting next to her and getting to see all the her reactions to stuff. She really liked this one. So whenever I rewatch it now, I remember her. And so, yeah.
So it's now part of the family.
Yeah, exactly.
That's awesome. Yeah, I have. So this I just remembered this, but I'm pretty sure when I saw Return of the King in high school, I had broken my leg. And so I had and I think it might have been when I had my leg. It was either in a straight leg cast because I broke my knee at one point, and then another time I broke an ankle. But I think it was the straight leg cast, and I went to the movie. And I had to like bring my own little like chair to prop my leg up. And I remember that, you know, being not fun, but the movie made up for it. And yeah, I agree. I have a hard time saying if it's my favorite. There's definitely parts of it that are some of my favorite things in the film trilogy. And overall as a film, I don't know if it's my favorite one. I feel like we've discussed, I feel like mine kind of shifted sometimes depending on which one I've most recently watched or which one I haven't watched in a while. And I think, oh, that one was the best. And, these films are great.
I will say my aunt's favorite scene in the movie was, cause I remember her ecstatic reaction in the theater was when Eowyn slays the Witch King.
Oh yeah.
That was her favorite moment. Yeah. She cheered out loud at that.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
Yeah, that was a cool scene. But yeah, we can talk about Eowyn now if we want to. But yeah, I mean, we kind of saw her in Two Towers, her like starting to become, because she wasn't really too much of a warrior then. I mean, she was, but we didn't get to see it other than like some brief sparring, I think. But this is like we actually get to see her full on in battle and slaying the Witch King, which no man could do. So she's having to hide it the whole time because, you know, her role, traditional role would be to stay behind and Théoden told her, I need you to rule in my stead. And because Théoden probably thought he's not coming back. So Faramir, he probably thought Faramir might not come back because this is like,
Éomer?
Éomer.
I don't think any of them thought they were coming back from that.
You mean when they were screaming death?
Death! Yeah, it's like
just awesome. But
yeah.
No, I mean, Eowyn is, again, one of my favorite female characters ever. And, you know, one of the things I love about the way Tolkien has wrote this character and the way he writes his female characters. I think I've said this before. Some people complain that there aren't a lot of female characters. Or they try to, you know, they don't like maybe the way they're portrayed. But every female character, whether it's Rosie or one of the Sackville Bagginses, you know, they're forced to deal with. And, you know, in his lore, the women are they're such strong feminine characters. And, you know, I was watching it today and watching Eowyn slay the Witch King, the thing that came into my mind was, take note, ladies, you do what men can't do. That's what you do. You don't try to do what men do. You do what they can't do because that's the job that needs to be done, you know? And I just think in the book, it comes across beautifully and in the film, it comes across beautifully. But what occurred to me today when I was watching the film is it says, no man can slay me. That's what he bragged about. But maybe Mary could have slain him. It could have been one of those two people. Yeah, those are the only two people on Pelennor Fields who could have killed the Witch King.
Yeah, I feel like Tolkien mentions that in the appendices somewhere.
Well,
he's like, because Mary gets the assist. He gets like the initial wounding.
I was
going to
say, in the book, it's the daggers they got from the Barrow Downs, I think, that Mary stabs him with, which was a dagger from Numenor, I think, or it may have even been from Valinor, but I think it was from Numenor. And I think this is a dagger that was he given this dagger by Galadriel when they left
in the movies?
So this is an elven dagger, so it's not, you know, maybe there was part of that is they just the Witch King never was going to fight an elf for one reason or another, but
yeah
I just noticed that
yeah
Yeah. Oh, and speaking of the Witch King, we've got an invented character. Well, he's not totally invented. The name is from the books, but in the books we know nothing about him except the name. But that is the Witch King's lieutenant, Gothmog, the guy who leads the sort of crippled orc who leads the armies. He's kind of an interesting character.
Yeah. But we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So much before.
There's so much.
We're already at Pelennor Fields right now.
Because it's the best. That's like the best part of the, well, in my opinion, the best part of the film. But anyway.
Well, so just to kind of backtrack, we can, you know, I was kind of thinking of some of the changes we could talk about from the books and what we think of them. And I think one of the biggest that always comes across to me, and I like it for the films, but I know some people prefer the original, is kind of the reluctance of Théoden and Aragorn in the film. Théoden, because initially Théoden saying he will not aid Gondor. Where was Gondor when the Westfold fell? He won't come to their aid. And Aragorn's like, if they call, you have to answer. You know, this kind of goes back to his reluctance in the second film, when he didn't want to stand and fight. He wanted to retreat to Helm's Deep. So I don't know if you, and same thing with Aragorn, his reluctance to kind of accept his destiny as being the king. So I don't know if either of you had any thoughts on either their reluctance or their being overcome or anything.
I think the whole reluctance thing is, it's a modern, it's a modern
convention.
Indulgence, shall we say. Convention. It's almost an indulgent, almost false humility, although that's not how it came across at all in the films. But I don't understand this. Yeah, I think it's just different because of the way Lord of the Rings is written. As I said, it's almost like a saga. It's like an English saga. And the heroes don't have any of these doubts about themselves, because that would have been frightening. I think nobody would want to hear a hero doubting himself, especially if it was like life or death. But I think today, because we have this, you know, absolute power corrupts absolutely kind of thing, you want to see somebody who's reluctant to take power, that, you know, that seems very virtuous. But also I think in that I'm losing my train of thought now. Now I'm rambling, but I think it gives them the depth that, I have to confess, in the book, Aragorn didn't have. Aragorn was a very predictable hero in the book, because he really was written in this traditional saga type hero. And that would be not interesting. So I think they introduced that reluctancy in him just to give him a little more texture as a character. And with Théoden, it might be the same. Although when I think about Théoden in the book, I thought he was perfect. I don't know why I didn't think they had to change anything about him. But then, like I said, he's one of my favorite characters ever.
Yeah, I think it's more of a drama type of thing. Like, there's more drama if Aragorn is reluctant, and, you know, it builds up the love story between him and Arwen more if he's reluctant to take his destiny. And we recently did our recorded reading day special, and one of my quotes that I picked, the topic was service and sacrifice, was Théoden's answer to the Gondor's call for aid. And in the book, the beacons are lit, Gondor calls for aid, or anything like that. It was, the beacons were more just a warning, and a rider was sent to Rohan to call for aid. And there's no doubt from Théoden.
They have a red arrow.
Yeah, it was an arrow. It was a symbol between them. And he said, something like, I'm going to speak no more of prudence. We will come, because he kind of knows at that point, like, if they don't defeat Sauron here, then there's no defeating Sauron.
Exactly.
If they don't take part in this. And then just the scene of Aragorn pulling the sword out of the reforged sword. It was great. I love that.
If it, everything, like the changes to Aragorn's character, yes, I understand from a dramatic filmmaking perspective why they did it. And though I love the book version more, like the changes they made were worth it for that line Elrond says, put aside the ranger, become who you were born to be. Which is, not only is it a great trailer line, because I believe it was in the trailers, yeah, it's just a great line overall. I love that.
He's redeemed himself. Mm-hmm. Elrond has.
Right, because throughout this the film trilogy, he's been kind of the stick in the mud.
Yes, yes. Stick in the mud. Yeah, yeah. Very inappropriate.
Whereas we don't get that. Tolkien describes Elrond as kind as summer, and we don't really get that in the films.
He's a little bit... He's cold. Like prickly, like like the blackberry bushes when there are no more blackberries on them.
Well, he's just a dad worried about his daughter dating that dirty guy from the
yeah,
that young upstart.
It's like he's not making anything of himself. He's just
exactly. Oh my gosh! You know what else was missing in this? Although there was a hint of it in the extended version, when you see Elrond going up to the camp of the Rohirrim, are the Pooka men? Remember that group?
The statues.
Yeah, but the real people, remember, and of course, I always wanted to see, I really was expecting to see them in the film the first time I saw the film, and they weren't there.
Oh, they have some great lines in the book.
They did, and they did so much work. I mean, what I thought
kill
was so great
orc
about...
folk. Yeah. Kill orc folk, no other words please wild men, and I'm like, yeah, like, that's great.
I know, get to the point. And yeah, also, you know, like, they would go out, they would do like scouting excursions, and they were like spies because they were so good in about tracking in the woods. I mean, I was disappointed that they weren't there, but there was a little nod to who they were.
Yes.
In the extended version.
Yeah, you see the creepy statues, and it's like,
yeah,
I love it. It's like, that's there like for the fans, because they don't explain the creepy statues. They're just there. But if you know what those are, you're like, oh, that's cool. You know?
Exactly. Yeah, oh, totally. When I saw them, I'm like, there they are. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, I don't think I've noticed those. Are you talking about when Aragorn's going into the mountain, or is that?
No, that's when Elrond is walking up towards where the camp is.
Yeah.
In like, Dunharrow.
Yes, because in the book, it says like at each turn, there was a carved Pooka man. They were called Pooka men by the Rohirrim. And then when the wild men came and they had this meeting with Theoden and Aragorn, it says that they resembled these statues.
Statues. Okay. Oh, and in the Unfinished Tales, there's a great story about how the Pooka men, they can inhabit those statues to make them be like golems, like statues that can move around and like kill orcs and stuff. There's a First Age story, and I can't remember what it's called now, but it's in Unfinished Tales where the statue actually the statues come to life and kill orcs. And that's cool.
It's like reverse trolls or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah, but yeah, ultimately Aragorn and Theoden overcome their reluctance because, you know, I think once Theoden decides he's going to aid Gondor because the beacons are lit, Gondor calls for aid and Rohan will answer. And from then on, it's like he's all in, which I thought was great. His, you know, we'll get to the Pelennor Fields a little bit later, but
yeah.
And he's like, even when he knows he doesn't have enough men, he's still like, it doesn't matter. We're still going.
Do you know what? Mm-hmm. This is why I love Theoden. Do you know what I mean? He does the right thing every time. And I think he was still. And what I think in the movie that comes across is his regret. He clearly felt like he had failed his people. You know, of course, he couldn't control any of it. He was poisoned or possessed or whatever. But you can still see he carried this burden of thinking he had failed his people, but he wasn't going to do it again. He wasn't going to let that happen again. And I think that comes across in this film so well. Now, I can't remember the name of the the actor who played him, but he just did a fan. He's, there's never going to be another Theoden but him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Bernard, what's his, I forget his last name.
Barnard. Bernard, we'll just call it Barnard.
Bernard Hill is his name. But
the only other thing I've ever seen him in, I think, is that he has a cameo at the beginning of Valkyrie. And I remember going, I'm like, where do I know this guy? And I'm like, oh, that's Theoden. And I was like, what? Because I was distracted because I recognized his voice. And I was like, what? Yeah, he plays like a German general at the very beginning of Valkyrie and he gets killed.
He's the captain in the Titanic.
Oh, is he?
I was saying. Mm-hmm. He was a television actor here. He was famous in the 1980s. My husband was saying he did a series. I can't remember what it was called, but he played like this hard union guy. And he would always say, yes, a job. That's all I know.
But yeah, Theoden was great. Aragorn as well. And I just love, yeah, when he draws the sword, and it just harkened back to Theoden's thing when in Two Towers, when Gandalf says, draw your sword and your arms will remember their strength better if you draw your sword. And so it's kind of that same thing, like drawing their sword.
That's a good comparison.
They find their strength. And because the whole time Elrond's saying, Arwen's dying. So, if you don't defeat Sauron, she's going to not last long in this world run by Sauron. So
don't you love that heroic idea of a man and his sword? Do you know what I mean? Like, where is that today? I just, how many men would love to draw a sword and gain strength through it, name your sword and go out and fight in days of yore.
Yeah. And some other changes, I kind of just wrote down a couple things here. We see the death of Saruman early in the film, because in the book, he's obviously not. He's there. He comes back at the very end in the Scouring of the Shire, which is not in the film.
Is Saruman's death only in the extended version, or is that in the theatrical cut too?
I think we might only see the death in the extended. I think in the theatrical, there might have been like, we might have seen them talking to Saruman, and then it's kind of implied he dies. I don't remember.
I can't remember.
I only watched the extended
editions but I love that scene where, Theoden, he's like, when you hang from a gibbet for the sport of your own crows, I will have peace with you in Orthanc. And
I know.
And in the book, there's even like there's this extended conversation before that where Saruman is like gaslighting them, trying to say that it's their fault. And he's using all this moral equivalency where he's like, oh, the Rohirrim have fought many wars against people they didn't like. And I'm like, No. None of that, Saruman. Like, you can't weasel your way out of this one with words, which is kind of, Theoden's rejoinder. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I think also that particular scene, Saruman reveals his contempt for everything in Middle Earth.
Yes.
Except power.
Mm-hmm.
And when Grima stabs him, it's like that was his last redeeming moment. Even though was it even redemption? It's like he finally could see that this man hates everybody. And he really did. The way he described, it was when he described the Rohirrim as,
the House of Rohan is a thatched barn where brigands drink in the reek and their brats roll on the floor among
with
their
the dogs.
Yeah. You are a lesser son of greater sires.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And when it was at that point where Grima just looked at him like suddenly he was free of the spell.
Mm-hmm.
And he stabbed him, But and also I think it's interesting how the compassion that Theoden showed Grima.
Yeah. Be free of him. He says, Yeah.
You can come back. You are a man of Rohan. But I think he probably has that compassion because he was possessed. He knows what Grima is going through, but I have to admit the first time I saw, it must've been in the theatrical edition, because I can remember at some point sitting there going, I guess Sharky's dead.
Yeah.
I guess we're not going to have the scourging of the Shire, because I thought, you know, but I, because I do remember seeing that, and I was thinking, like, in the back of my head, like, it was just running in the back of my head as I was going through the movie for the first time. What are they going to do with the Shire when they go back to the Shire? What's going to happen? And now we know. But yeah, so it must have been a very strong hint that Sharky was not heading to the Shire from that scene.
And he gets impaled, which I don't know if that was meant. OK, because Christopher Lee also played Dracula.
Yeah.
And you kill Dracula by staking him.
Yeah.
So I almost felt like when he falls on that spike, I'm like, was that kind of like a
nod.
A nod to him playing Dracula?
Apparently, when they were doing that, I guess the sound editors and Peter Jackson was like, oh, we're going to do this. And they stabbed something. And like, that's how it sounds when somebody's stabbed. And Christopher Lee says, no, it's not.
Like, you will know.
What? What are you talking about?
Because he was James Bond, basically. Like,
yeah, in real life.
In real life.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I just looked, and Saruman, he was not in the theatrical cut at all, so...
Okay.
I guess the movie was already so long.
It was so long. Yeah, he just kind of disappears.
Yeah, if you don't watch the extended, yeah, then his storyline just kind of ends, but... Yeah, and along with another, you know, unless y'all have anything else on Saruman, another kind of crazy villain we get is Denethor here. And he is, in the book, not such a villain.
He's even crazier in this. Like,
yeah, he's not really that much of a villain in the book. They even talk about how he's like a very high lord and he's a very noble guy. You know, he's still kind of a jerk, but he's not like completely insane and a villain until the very end, because we do find out that he's looking into the into, I think they have their own Palantir, and he's been looking into it and, you know, getting,
you know what he comes off as, and I can't quite place why, he reminds me, the movie Denethor reminds me of a Disney villain. There's just something about him, his portrayal, that screams Disney villain. Maybe it's just of how unpleasant he is.
Maybe because his coats look like Ursula the sea monster.
Oh, you know, yeah, the big fur coat that he's got on. Cruella, yeah, well, like Cruella de Vil. Yeah,
Cruella de Vil. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
I think with him, now I have to say, in the film, he strongly suggests that he's been looking into the Palantir when he says, I've seen more than you know, Mithrandir, you know. And so I think at that point he was already crazy, but he was just not a likable man.
So many memes of him, eating. People have memed that scene where it's like,
I hate that scene because I'm kind of funny about, like, I don't like to see people eat, you know, that's not my thing. But then to see people eat and then make a mess is disgusting to me.
Yeah.
I just, yeah. And
the way they intercut it with the men dying.
And Pippin's song is like brilliant. Great song.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, do you know what? When I was watching that and they were showing the juxtaposition of his eating like a pig and everyone getting slaughtered, it's almost like they were just being crushed the way he was crushing that food. He was so careless in the way he did it. And it's like the men were no more than the food. You know, it was him crushing and just devouring this food.
Yeah,
and
they're grist
perfectly
for the war machine.
That's exactly how he saw them, including his own son. So he was not a likable character in any way, shape or form. And I don't even think he really loved Boromir. I think Boromir was just a means to an end.
Yeah, I mean, I think Boromir for him was probably like, he's like the ideal son. Like he's a big martial guy and is, you know, so he's kind of your, you know, Denethor is kind of the failed athlete whose son becomes
living vicariously through his son.
And he's like, look what my son has done. And, you know, he says when he's talking to Faramir, he's like, your brother held these defenses and kind of blaming. And I've speculated that, you know, Faramir reminds him of his mother. So maybe that's why Denethor has some of his has some dislike of him.
Yeah, but he was not a redeemable character. In fact, he was, I guess, foil would not be the right word for Theoden, because, you know, each the hobbits, the young hobbits are split up. One goes with Theoden and becomes
a squire,
a marshal of the Rohirrim. Is that it? And then you've got an esquire. And then Mary, poor Mary goes and he gets shackled to this psychopath.
Crazy old guy.
Yeah. Well,
he does it to himself when he pledges the oath. And
he did. Yeah. Yeah.
And he looked in the Palantir, and that's the whole reason they're there in the first place, which, by the way, they changed a bit from the book where, like, Pippin looking in the Palantir gives them the clue that Minas Tirith is going to be the target because he sees the white tree burning. And they kind of do that for the audience, because in the book, there's no question that Minas Tirith is going to be where.
Yeah, because you've got to defeat your biggest enemy. And if you want to, you know, they're the only thing standing against him.
Yeah. But, you know, going back to, if you compare Denethor and the way he treated Pippin in the film and the way and the tenderness that Theoden had for Mary, you know, just such different men. You know, and they're from the world of men, mm-hmm. or the race of men. And I think the film does a really good job of showing who a man can be, or what a man can be. It can be like Theoden, or it can be like Denethor. They're just so opposite.
That thing where he says, like, you know, when Faramir calls him out basically and says, like, you wish I were dead. And that Boromir was alive. And Denethor just admits, yes, I wish that. And you're like, dude, like.
I know. He's horrible.
In the book, he's even, some of the things he says that they left out were like, he's like, he says to Faramir, like, you know, I forebode that worse lay in the dregs. Like, he's calling him the dregs of, like, the cub. It's like, you don't speak this way to your son.
Yeah, I know. Like, well, and the thing is, you know, when they were again going to their deaths, mm-hmm. At Osgiliath, I mean, that's certainly, I'm talking about, you know, Lent and thinking about the Holy Week and that sort of thing. When they're throwing the flowers down, this is like Christ going into Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they knew they were going, these men were going to their deaths. And, when Gandalf says, "Oh, Faramir, your father loves you. He just doesn't know it."
He will show it before you will know it before the end.
And guess what? No, he didn't love him. Because if you love someone, you don't try to set them on fire.
But yeah, and, you know, well, I think they kind of hint at that when Denethor's about to die, when Pippin pulls Faramir off the pyre, and Denethor thinks he's dead, and he's like convinced himself, you know, in his psychotic break with reality that he's dead. And then he sees Faramir living, and he's like, "My son is alive." So there's maybe just a tiny little bit.
You're super nice. Spark. No.
speaking of changes from the book, characters who they left out. It's already an overcrowded movie, so I get why they cut this character. But Prince Imrahil, because he has an inch, because he's Faramir and Boromir's uncle. He's the brother. He's basically Denethor's brother-in-law. He's an interesting character because, like, when in the book, when Faramir is injured, he's the one who brings Faramir back, and you can just feel the seething in his voice when he says, "Your son has returned, Lord, after great deeds." Like Imrahil's mad. He's like, "My sister married you and she died. And now the only connection to my sister left, her youngest son, is going to die. And it's all your fault." Like, you can.
Yeah.
He doesn't say that, but you get the subtext. And that's very interesting.
Yeah,
He's an interesting character.
Yeah. I really wanted to see Imrahil in my mind. Like, one of the men going off to war was Imrahil. In fact, I even thought that today when I was watching it, I'm like, that one is Imrahil.
He's just off camera. You can't see him.
You can't see him. Yeah.
Yeah. Looking for the swan on his armor. You know?
The swan knights. When they describe that armor in the book, that sounds so cool. You know?
Like, yeah. Do you know, we went to Poland years ago, and talk about amazing armor in this museum. they had some medieval armor, and it was all like, it looked like the helmets of Gondor with like literally the swan wings coming up.
Oh,
amazing.
Cool.
Yeah. So that is another thing I think of, if they had, so it wasn't like just the little feathers, it were like massive feathers coming around. And it was, and I was like, this is the real deal. Like there were people walking around on this planet like that in this age.
I would say this is the same planet. What are you talking about?
I know, but this age, yeah. You're right. I'm getting mixed up with the Star Wars universe. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, in the swan, I mean, and just to, that's, I mean, yeah, we're, that's not even in the film, but in the swans, that goes back to, we're doing the Silmarillion, and we just did the chapter where we get kind of the description of Valinor. And one of the things described is these swans that pull the boats of the Teleri into the harbor. At first. So yeah, just like, you know, I'm sure somewhere someone's out there made like the red string connection as of when Tolkien wrote each line of the Legendarium. But I'm wondering if, you know, there's that connection with the Swan Knights, the good dating back to that, but
probably.
But yeah. You know, unless y'all want to talk more about Denethor, I kind of don't.
Horrible.
The actor's good. John Noble is great because this was the only thing I'd really seen him in, and then I've since watched Fringe, and that's a great show.
Yes, he was fantastic in Fringe.
I'm glad John Noble is not the he's not typecast as a villain. He's had other villainous roles.
I'm not as familiar with Star Trek, but I think he voiced one of the bad guys in Star Trek Prodigy, the new animated show.
Oh, he might. Oh, I think he does. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I haven't seen Prodigy because I can't get it over here. So,
yeah.
Can I say one thing? About Denethor? He is the personification of despair. And after watching it again today, I can see why I'm so glad despair is a sin. You know, it is so damaging. Not to say that despair is something easy to avoid, but it's something worth avoiding, trying your best to avoid. And when you see him, he really is the personification of someone who's completely and utterly given up hope.
Mm-hmm.
And when, again, I keep making all these references, like I said, I think because it's Lent and I'm, you know, all these things that are coming into our minds at this time of the year, when Gandalf runs into, you know, gallops into the halls as Faramir is being set alight. To me, the first thing I thought was, is this what the harrowing of hell looked like? Coming in, and he just kind of bonks Denethor on the head. You know, well, he bonked him on the head first when he's like, flee for your lives. And it's like, really? And so he smacks him on the head, you know, smacks him on the bonce, and so one time, and then he kind of gathers himself, and you'd think that would be enough to kind of knock some sense into Denethor. But then I think I'm going to light my son on fire. So when he comes in on Shadowfax and just rears up, and I thought, is that like the harrowing of hell coming down and snatching life from the jaws of death?
Yeah. Well, if he got hit on the head, it wasn't his fault because he had a concussion and had a head injury. So I'm kidding. Denethor apologist over here. No,
there you go.
Well, and one note I had is in the camp, and I mean, I didn't have time to read I wish I could have read the whole book right before we did this, but in the Rohirrim's camp, to go back to that, when all that's going on, Merry, he gets outfitted with armor and a sword, and Eowyn's like, you know, says, they're kind of talking, and he sends, she says, you know, go get that sword sharpened. And Eowyn's talking to Eomer about, you know, why can't he fight for the ones he loves? And Eomer just starts dissing Merry. And my only thought is, dude, Merry fought at Isengard. He fought Uruk-hai. He was in Khazad Dûm. Like, he's done all this
stuff.
But he
doesn't. And, but he's little.
Right.
That's probably all he sees. He's just this little guy.
And I love Aramir too. He's one of my guys. But yeah, I was like, come on, man. Like you could have heard some tell of this, that yes, he's little, but he's fought in these, you know, he may not have fought in a big, you know, cavalry charge, but he's fought in battles. And
yeah. And do you know what? Hobbits are tough. Like when I was watching it today at the Battle of on Pelennor Fields, you know, when some orc, I don't know if the orc was going to kill, trying to kill Eowyn. I think it was, because there was one where he's like, we thought he was dead, and then he's like coming back to life and blah, blah.
Yeah,
and
Goth, I was like, I think that's Scott.
Really? Come on, die already. But anyway, but
he's not dead yet.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But when Mary was fighting him, like a man, you know, full grown man that would like stand and fight. But did you see how Mary like wrapped his legs around his waist really tight so he couldn't get him off? And, mm-hmm. and he was just stabbing him over and over again. I was like, that's pretty brutal. That's brutal fighting, you know, but he learned how to, maybe that's how hobbits fight. How the Tooks take down people. Well, remember in the Scourging of the Shire, think about that. Of course, it's not in the film, but you think about hobbits fighting those men like that. They were probably like, what on earth did we get ourselves into?
It's like Ewoks.
Yeah, I was about to say.
Yes. Yeah. You see somebody on a spit being turned at the end of the day under the party tree.
Yeah, I mean, and but yeah, we're kind of getting to the point where, you know, and we're spending all this time talking about what's going on with everybody but Frodo and Sam. So we can talk about them. But yeah, did any of y'all have any notes or anything to say on the kind of the preparing for the battle? I think we can kind of save the Pelennor Fields and the last part to the end to discuss. But yeah, I mean, we've already talked about
another thing that's like the harrowing of hell is the Oathbreakers.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Aragorn goes under the earth and there's all these spirits there who are trapped because of their oath. And, you know, what say you? You know, like he's able to get there. Whereas, like, I think in the theatrical cut, it just ends there with him saying, what say you? But in the extended version, it goes on where they have like the avalanche of skulls that comes out of the necropolis. I don't know if any of you have watched some of the behind the scenes material on that, but like
not on this one. No,
they actually made, like, you know, those skulls were props that they made, and they actually had an avalanche of real like skull props that they had to wade through. Yeah.
I would have nightmares forever. Even knowing their props, I would be like, nope.
No, I was looking at that and I thought, how many people are in this city?
Yeah, today? I thought the same thing.
It's just like the size of New York.
Well, yeah, presumably it's the Oathbreakers, but maybe they're like all of their previous ancestors too. So
yeah, one thing I would like to say about when they were in going to the Dimmolt, that scene looked so much like the illustrations of Alan Lee, who did all, you know, he's famous for the illustrations for Tolkien books. And he was consulted on all three of the films. But that one, for whatever reason, like the mountains and everything, if you look at some of his watercolors, they absolutely brought it to life, brought it to 3D. It was beautiful. Mm. The same thing with the doors of the gates of Mordor. It just looks like something Alan Lee would have painted.
Yeah.
They were amazing.
But yeah, since we kind of touched on, we could maybe go to talk about Frodo and Sam and their journey, and then kind of wrap back around to the Pelennor Fields in the end. But I will say, when I rewatch this one, I often will skip some of the Frodo and Sam scenes because it's just kind of depressing.
That's the whole point.
I know.
That's the whole point, Jeff.
I want to be inspired by these great, you know, glorious battles, you know, and
yeah, he's carrying the cross is what he's doing. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But, rewatching it for this, it just like Sam's just, I was kind of and I knew it was in there, but I'm kind of bummed out of the whole Sam being sent away thing. And I know it was just to amp up the drama, but like Sam, in my head, I was like, Sam, you wouldn't leave. Like, you would follow behind them and out of sight or something. Like, you wouldn't leave Frodo alone. And because in the book, they're together the whole time.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up that point, because first of all, the whole conversation, the tension between those three, it kind of reminded me of, and sadly, there are a lot of people who can relate to this, you know, when you've got someone who has a really hard addiction in the family, and you've got somebody who's like, this is wrong, what are you doing? And maybe you've got the parent who just wants their kid, you know, and that's what it looked like to me, that, you know, Frodo is like the dad who's like, I know my kid's a liar and a thief, I know it, but I don't want him to die. And then you've got the other sibling going, but dad, you know, and it was hard and painful. And you had sympathy for everyone, less so for Gollum, you know, but it was really a really well done scene about the pain of a toxic relationship between three people. And I agree with you, Jeff. I don't know. In fact, in my notes, I was like, why did they separate Sam? Because at the end of the day, they didn't need to. You know,
I mean, I think just to amp up the drama, and
but yeah. Oh, like, there's not enough drama in Shelob's lair. he could have been there, because that part of the book, you know, when they're holding hands, walking through there, and I can't remember the exact words, but they were saying these were the two bravest souls on Middle Earth to do what they were doing. And they didn't know what they were doing. You know, these hobbits are amazing creatures, as Gandalf would say. And I don't know how he could. I mean, he didn't go all the way down to the bottom. You know, he fell to a certain degree, saw the Lembas. I like to think he picked it up, and after crumbling it in his hand, he's like, okay, I'm going to save it now. But then it's like, you found it, so now go back. And then he's like, shows up anyway. So I don't understand why they did that. I don't think they needed to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, yeah. And I noticed, I hadn't thought about that before. I was like, I don't think Sam would have left. Like, he would have, maybe stayed behind, you know, out of sight, and like still followed them. But yeah, their whole journey from, because Frodo gets stabbed by the Shelob, and then Sam, you know, fends off Shelob enough, but the orcs take Frodo to, but Sam gets the ring and all of Frodo's, you know, all of his stuff. He loots Frodo, for lack of a better. Well, yeah. I guess not the mithril shirt, but he gets the ring and staying in the light. And yeah, Frodo gets taken, and Sam has to go and pretend to be an orc kind of start an orc like battle between different groups of orcs in order to save Frodo, because he's at the top of this tower, and there's one set of orcs guarding him and another set that's like, we're going to take him, and the other orc doesn't want to let him have him. And
that shiny shirt. That's mine. And then, of course, they just start fighting, because like,
I know, because they're horrible. They're horrible. Yeah. But, you know, again, so going back, when Frodo was runs into Shelob, can you imagine? Oh, my gosh.
Gross.
And he falls, and he lifts his head up, and he's actually like in this garden with Galadriel. And she smiles at him, and she lifts him up. Again, thinking about the Stations of the Cross, I thought about when St. Veronica wipes the face of Christ. You know, and when I thought about it, I thought, wow, here she did. And what would that have looked like? That compassion. Mm-hmm. And that's what Galadriel gave him. And, you know, it was a beautiful, it's beautiful in the midst of that. It's almost like we all needed that little break, even though it was like not even 10 seconds. It was just enough where you could go, oh, because going into that layer was horrible. Did you see all those like holes that were drilled into the wall? Like, who was making all those little boring holes that looked like,
It didn't look like a fun place to go. Like, no.
But it's like, it's like that little moment of grace.
Yes.
That happens. And that was a nice little addition.
you know, I think later on, after seeing the movies, when I went and reread the books, I was surprised that that wasn't in there.
Yeah,
because it seemed like we would have been something from the books, but it wasn't.
You needed it. We all needed it, you know, but I'm just looking at some of my notes. I will say this, and this is before, you know, my patience, any compassion I had for Gollum, like, left after he got to the Shelob, after he kicked Sam out, you know,
crumbs just, on his jackets.
I know.
He had already in the Two Towers film, he had already decided he was going to he was going to do. So you, at that point, like, you know, anything he says is a lie. Like, even in Two Towers.
Yeah.
But I wrote that Frodo is a saint. I mean, even after Gollum betrayed him over and over and over again, and was like, he stood above him, and he had Sting, and he was going to kill him. And, you know, then of course Gollum starts whinging and whining, and he has compassion on him, which is good that he had it. But I just thought, oh my gosh, this is like supernatural, because I would have killed that thing a long time ago. And then, of course,
well, it's the Iluvatar, because they needed
needed
Gollum to be the one. Because, I mean, Frodo in the end wasn't going to throw the ring away. And I don't think any creature would have willingly thrown the ring away. I think you needed.
Not at that point, not being that close to Mount Doom. You're right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think, but what they needed was the best hobbit in the Shire to get it to Mount Doom.
Oh, and then of course when they're captured, you know, it's by the orcs, you know, don't you know we're at war? You know,
when they put on the orc stuff and they have to fall in with a group, because they
still, if they could have found a way to include the song from the animated version, would have been funny. Where there's a whip.
There's a way.
I haven't had the pleasure of watching that. So I think I've seen that.
You, that's a good way to introduce your children to The Hobbit. Although that one scared my girls, because apparently the orcs had double throats or something.
And
my girls were like, that's wrong.
They have two, like, the thing that hangs down in the back of your throat. They have two of them. It's gross.
Yeah. And so my girl's like, that's their big takeaway from those films. The orcs have two throats.
They end up being captured. But it's funny, because that ends up, they've been trying to avoid being captured the whole time, but it brings them closer to where they got to go.
Yeah.
Eventually.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, and then they have to, after they finally get away, and there's that, well, they finally get to Mount Doom, and, you know, and Gollum pops up for the last time, but we should mention, Sam says, I can't carry it for you, Mr. Frodo, but I'll carry you, and he
tearjerker
lifts him up on his back, and
like Simon of Cyrene. See, Tolkien is dying. Stop making these metaphors allegories.
Yeah. But before we kind of wrap up theirs, I think they're pretty much throwing the ring in the fire at that point. I think, Alex, when we think we're ready to get to the Ride of the Rohirrim, and I think you wanted to read the last paragraph of that, so go ahead and go for it.
That's true. Yeah. So this is, you know, one of the best scenes in the film, and it's one of the best scenes in the book. So I managed to read it again today and read it out loud to the animals. They loved it. Suddenly, the king cried to Snowmane, and the horse sprang away. Behind him, his banner blew in the wind, white horse upon a field of green, but he outpaced it. After him thundered the knights of his house, but he was ever before them. Éomer rode there, the white horse tail of his helm floating in his speed, and the front of the first Éowred roared like a breaker foaming to the shore. But Théoden could not be overtaken. Fey he seemed, or the battle fury of his fathers ran like new fire in his veins, and he was borne up upon Snowmane like a god of old, even as Orome the Great in the Battle of the Valar when the world was young. His golden shield was uncovered, and lo, it shone like an image of the sun, and the grass flamed into green about the white feet of his steed. For morning came, morning and a wind from the sea, and the darkness was removed, and the hosts of Mordor wailed, and the terror took them, and they fled and died, and the hooves of the wrath rode over them. And then all the host of Rohan burst into song, and they sang as they slew, for the joy of the battle was on them, and the sound of their singing, that was a fair and terrible, came even to the city. Yes.
Yeah. That's probably one of my favorite paragraphs in the whole trilogy.
Oh, it's so amazing. Good.
I'm glad you chose that.
I love it. I mean, I didn't do it justice by a long way, as Samwise Gamgee would say. But I just love it. It's like,
I love how they mention Orome. Yes. The Valar. That
yes. So I mean, cool. Yeah, and the Eowred, and just, you can see him. This is when he becomes more than just a man on that field. You know, that's his big redemption arc. It's just amazing. I think this film was as much about Denethor's redemption as it was anything else.
I like, Davins. Yeah, they you can see how Tolkien poured all his kind of love for like Anglo-Saxon culture into that paragraph, you know, like,
yeah,
that was just his love letter to the old sagas.
Oh yeah. Do you know, I remember reading this out loud to some Norwegian friends, and they're like, that is beautiful. Read it again.
Yeah. And that, yeah, this, the Battle of Pelennor Fields is it, I think it's my favorite battle. I mean, there's not that many in the films, but and Helm's Deep is great. But I think I like the Pelennor Fields just because it's everybody coming together. Minas Tirith, Gondor, yeah. Rohan.
The Eagles.
Well, not I guess in the film, not it.
Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're at the Black Gate. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry.
And then, yeah, they charge. They think they've defeated the orcs, and then they hear the horn of the Haradrim, and they. And just, there's some great face acting in this movie from
Viggo Mortensen. Oh, the look on Théoden's face.
And Bernard Hills. Yeah, he's like, I know that. I've had that look when I just, like, something happens. You're just like.
Yeah. And he goes, reform the lines. I mean, this is what I love about Théoden. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, we just had an epic battle that we just won. And now we got to fight again. I just loved it. Yeah, yeah. The facial expressions of the writers of the Oliphants were pretty great as well. Yeah. You know, I think when I was reading, I don't know where I posted this. I'll have to post it on the Discord for Middle Earth, Secrets of Middle Earth. When we went to the British Museum several weeks ago, I think I posted, I think I found the Horn of Gondor, and it was this horn.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, those are called Oliphants.
Really?
Yes. So I'll have to post it when this comes out. I'll post it on the Secrets of Middle Earth Discord so everyone can see it. But you can, it's beautiful. It's amazing. It's like, there was like, you can see where all of this film was coming from, things that actually existed in this world.
Yeah. And I mean, like the using of elephants as essentially tanks, you know, is a thing that happened in real life, you know, in the Punic Wars between Rome and Carthage. You know, Hannibal had his elephants you know, and they say that, like, you know, they were very effective against cavalry because horses won't charge an elephant.
Neither will a person.
A person, yeah. And it's like, to have something that's essentially, you know, like indestructible, you know, just walking around and stomping on everything. And these are not even normal elephants. They're like,
no, they're Oliphants.
They're like dinosaur sized elephants.
Yeah. Mammoths.
And you have like, of course, the Legolas can do anything comes to its crescendo in that battle where he takes out the entire you know, Oliphant, and Gimli's like, it still only counts as one.
The battle is just so, it's terrible for being, because it's a battle, but it's just such an epic thing, like, because you have the charge of the Rohirrim first, after the orcs have been sieging Minas Tirith, and then they defeat the orcs, then the Haradrim come in with the Oliphants, and then to wrap it all up, you have Aragorn, Legolas, and Gimli finally arriving with the army of the dead, right. And they just charge across the field, and you know they're the ones that I believe kill Gothmog in the end, because I think he's like crawling after Eowyn, or he's crawling after her.
I thought that was Merry who killed him, but maybe not. Yeah, maybe not. Yeah,
but they're the ones who kill him. But yeah, then the whole ghost, and then yeah, Legolas is. He does his, you know, his parkour to.
Yeah, I have here in my notes how I think the beginning of the Battle of Pelennor Fields, how there's no music. You know, you just hear the sounds of the battle, and it kind of is like it adds to, because I notice watching it, like I'm holding my breath the whole time. And then once the music starts, then you go, okay, I'm going to, oh yeah, it's a film. It's
the only music is the trolls beating time. Yeah,
it's really intense.
As they bring up the huge battering ram. Grond. You know, like it's
the name of Melkor's hammer or Morgoth's hammer.
Yeah, they named it after Melkor's mace. Yeah. And then and again, I saw in the behind the scenes materials when it sort of kind of breaks through the door, but not completely, that they didn't plan that. That was an accident. But they're like, oh, we'll keep it, though.
Yeah, yeah. No, and, happy and accident.
And they're like, you know, whatever comes through that gate, stand your ground. And it's like Olog Hai, you know, like the fighting trolls come through. And it's like, oh, jeez.
I know. Okay. I know. And yet, you know, in these battles of old, that's what you had to do. There was no other. What else were they going to do? Where are you going to run?
Yeah, you can't run anywhere.
Jump on the pyre with Denethor. Yeah.
And several times Gandalf had to rally the troops.
He did because they were so afraid.
And they throw the heads over the wall.
Yeah,
again, that's a real historical thing that would happen in some of these sieges.
Yeah, like the psychological war that was being fought by Mordor against especially Gondor. You know, they were already traumatized just by being in the vicinity of Mordor. You know, and when they had the this is going way back, but you know, when the Black Gates open, or not the City of the Dead, if I'm correct, when the Witch King comes out and they have that big green like poison looking light coming down, and everyone was like terrified. It was just one more trauma for them to have to deal with. And poor Pippin, he'd never seen anything like that in his life.
Right. And him and Gandalf have that very moving exchange when it looks like the city's going to be taken.
Yeah.
And Gandalf kind of describes like death to him and like going over to the other end. Death is not the end.
It's one path we all must take, except
white
for Gandalf.
Shores and a far green country.
Like that's one of my favorite Tolkien quotes, because we talked about this before, but that's in it's in Fellowship when they're, I believe, resting in Tom Bombadil's house. Frodo has the vision of this, and he says, and you know, the gray curtain rolls away, and you see a rolling green countryside under a swift sunrise. And that's kind of, that's kind of the vision of the Undying Lands. But in the film, it's a Pippin and Gandalf exchange. But yeah, I love that, because that's kind of like the rallies Pippin to, you know, to keep going too.
Another Lenten connection is like right before that, with the encounter, both in the book and the movie, between Gandalf and the Witch King. And the Witch King's like, you know, this is my hour. You know, it reminds me of in Gethsemane, when Jesus is taken, he says to the soldiers, but I believe, and this is just my opinion, he's not really talking to the soldiers. He's talking to someone else who's there.
Yeah.
He says, this is your hour, the time of the power of darkness.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, I believe Jesus is speaking to the enemy. who's there, you know, like this is the time of the power of darkness. And like, so you have the reversal of that where the Witch King says, this is my hour.
Yeah. You know? And I think also in that, the whole experience, when I was looking at Pippin this time around, I don't know how Billy Boyd did it, but he looks like he's like 10 years old. And you know, because 10-year-olds, they're aware enough of the world that they kind of know, like, there can be some pretty bad people in the world and there can be some serious consequences. You know, the world is they're starting to see the world as a dangerous place, or can be a dangerous place. And it was just the way he conveyed that kind of innocence, but slowly realizing, even because even after all the stuff he had gone through, he was always joking, always kind of getting into trouble. But after that Palantir, after he looked into that, he really changed. And it's almost like he was looking at the world in a completely different way. And the way Billy Boyd just, I don't know, his facial expressions, it was like a young kid that, you know, say, oh, you know, somebody got hurt that you really love, or, you know, your pet got injured for whatever reason. And they have to like come to terms with, wow, the world can be a painful, dangerous place. And he just showed that over and over again. And then in the end, when, you know, yay, the ring was destroyed, and then he came in, he kind of had that boyish innocence about him again. But you could almost, he just conveyed innocence dying just a little bit. And that, yeah, it was heartbreaking. It was hard, you know, when he was looking around, he was looking at what was going on. And when Gandalf said that to him, he did have a little bit of peace. But like a child, you know, it was really tough
right.
to see.
Yeah.
Well, I think the kind of one of the last notes I have, at least in terms of a difference, because we're getting kind of, they obviously survived Pelennor Fields, and Merry and Eowyn survive. Théoden, unfortunately, passes away. But they go to the Houses of Healing, where Aragorn comes in and helps heal them. And in the book, there's a whole chapter on it, which it's a great, I love the chapter in the book
with the old lady running back and forth.
But they eventually decide that we need to draw Sauron's eye and give Frodo time. And so they marched on the Black Gate, and there's, you know,
I love what Gimli says, by the way, when they're like, you know, Sauron's still there, and he's like, let him stay there. Let him rot.
and then when they decide to do it, he's like, low chance of success. Why not?
I love that. Yeah, it's like certainty of death, small chance of success.
What are we waiting for? But, you know, I don't know if it's my favorite scene, but it's close, is when, you know, the men march on the Black Gate, and they've done the negotiation or whatever with the mouth of Sauron. And the men they're just kind of waiting for the end. And like, they know that all of them hopefully know that they may not come out of this alive, because they're ultimately trying to give Frodo time. And Aragorn's speech, and I'm not going to do it because I couldn't do it justice, but I love his speech of, you know, men of Gondor, of Rohan, my brothers. And I that's one of my favorite things. And I like, it sounds very Tolkien.
Men of the West.
Did you stand?
Men of the West. And it inspires everybody. And then ultimately they prepare to charge, and Aragorn looks back with one last look to them, and for Frodo charges. And then
with a tear in his eye.
Right, yeah.
And then Merry and Pippin are the first to go.
was cool.
Yeah. Do you know, don't you love hobbits? They're just the best.
That's great.
You know, if somebody like compares you to a hobbit, take it as a compliment, because they're tough. They are tough little people, and they're not afraid. Yeah. It's just,
or they are, but they overcome their fears.
Yeah. Well, I'm just thinking about, going back when Mary was talking to Eowyn in the camp, and I think he kind of he told her that he loved her. You know,
There was kind of,
not like a romantic love, but a brotherly love, a real brotherly love. And like, we're going to do this. We're going to die together. You and I
don't know. I don't know. I, I mean, I hope that's the case and that it wasn't meant to be any kind of weird romance thing.
No, no, I didn't think so. No, I think it was more brother, like a little brother and a big sister and facing a really difficult situation. Yeah,
or even could be like a Gimli Galadriel type of courtly love kind of.
Yeah.
I mean, she is of the House of Aeorl and he's an esquire of the House of Aeorl.
So. That's true. He's also a brandy buck.
Mm-hmm. Yes, master of Buckland, Meriadoc the Magnificent. He becomes
exactly. But it was a lot of it. Made me think of: is this kind of what it was like? These conversations in the trenches during World War One that guys had.
Well, he said, like I read somewhere that Tolkien said, like Sam is an amalgam of several like sergeants and enlisted men that he knew who were like from rural England. He represents the kind of yeoman, you know, every man Englishman, you know,
who's not going anywhere. Do you know what I mean? Honestly, like that's I live in rural England and I run into lots of hobbits in a really good way.
Well, I mean, and then they, to say, wrap things up, Frodo and Sam, they get to the Crax of Doom and Frodo decides not to throw it in. Gollum attacks Frodo, gets the ring and then falls in and they're finally free of it. And they get out and think they're about to die, but then the eagles are coming.
I love how he brings it back around to the ending of The Hobbit.
Yeah,
I guess Pippin's the one that says the eagles are coming, and then they, and then after they, because the eagles are there to fight off the Nazgul flying in the air, and then they go and save Frodo and Sam, and then everyone, the whole fellowship. Well, earlier I said the fellowship survives. The only one who we lost was Boromir, but the rest of them survive to the end, and then there's
He brings in eagles because. One of his patrons is Saint John, you know, his first name being John. Tolkien had a devotion. He had a devotion to Saint John. And of course the symbol of John the Evangelist is the eagle.
Yes, it is.
And so brings in the eagle at these pivotal moments, you know?
Yeah. Because there's the suggestion that the eagles aren't just eagles.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That they are.
Quahir is not just an eagle.
They can talk.
Wear jewelry.
Right. Yeah. They're either Maiar or they are animals that have somehow been uplifted to by the Valar. But yeah, like, and I like how too, what is it? They conveniently at the end when the ring is destroyed, get rid of all the orcs by having that big chasm.
it's like a giant toilet flushing.
But they don't, though. You see all the orcs running away. Like there's a lot that actually run away.
That's true. So
because kind of hint, and it's like, where are they going to go?
But I thought in the book it's almost like they disintegrated, or you know, they just kind of crawled in holes and died.
Well, I think they kind of ran for the hills to try to hide wherever they could.
He says Aragorn, it's like when a termite nest, you disturb it and they all kind of run away.
Because Aragorn and Amir spend, like it talks about in the appendices, how they go and hunt down.
That's true.
Some of these, you know, nests of orcs, but.
And there's no redemption to them, right? It's not like you can convince them to do something else.
Right.
It'll be something else. And of course, the book, the follow up, the sequel to Lord of the Rings, which Tolkien never wrote, suggests that some of these orc like creatures survived in the Age of Men and were kind of causing havoc.
They're evil men who are like everyone by the time that story is taking place, the War of the Ring is beyond living memory. So people so there are like cults of Sauron worshipers and all kinds of stuff. It's like where it's like people have forgotten, you know, like it kind of reminds me of today when like, you know, the last of that World War II generation is slipping away.
And how quickly all this stuff comes back.
And it's going to be without, beyond living memory. And you're just like, oh, that's not good. Like, you know,
especially if you don't know history.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's the danger of it.
And that's the thing. Like he said many times, he's like, look, this story is not meant to be an allegory for World War II. And it's not. But at the same time, the influence is there. He wrote a lot of it during the war. And you can see kind of the influence where it's that, you know, where the evil is so obviously starkly evil that it's like in that, you know, you don't want people to forget what happened.
Yeah.
You know,
I think the book is timeless and the, I guess if you want to call it the lessons that you can learn from this book, because all of these things can come up again. You know, this is a story that will make sense. It would have made sense 1,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. It's going to make sense 1,000 years from now because we're human beings living in a fallen world. And I love throughout his book or all of the books, at the end of the day, there's hope always. And of course in the films as well, There's little hints of it, like when they see the head of the statue of the king when they're walking, when they're making their way. When Frodo, Sam, and Gollum are trying to get to Mordor, and the sun shines down on the king's head, and the flowers become brighter, and Sam goes, "Look, the king has got his crown again." Now in the book, Frodo says, they cannot reign forever. These people who are here, and he doesn't say it in the film, because I think in the film he was feeling pretty low, and it would not have been consistent with the scene. But yeah, there's that hope, and I just loved what Frodo said, that these people who are taking over, they can't last.
Yeah. Well, and the hope is ultimately the hope is restored when Aragorn is crowned and.
Great scene. I bow to no one.
Well, and before that, I love the song because it's the oath of Elendil.
Yes.
that Elendil gives when, you know, for spoiler alert for Silmarillion, when Elendil comes and founds the kingdoms of Gondor and Arnor, that's the oath he gives when he kind of founds the kingdoms.
Yeah, I think it's just in Sindarin in the or Quenya in the film, but the translation is, out of the great sea to Middle Earth I am come. In this place I shall abide, and my heirs unto the ending of the world.
Yes. Beautiful.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Just beautiful.
Yeah.
It is. It's almost biblical.
It's epic. Mm-hmm. It's epic.
Yeah.
What can I say?
And just to kind of wrap up, you know, if this was the 80s, we would have gotten a montage saying of each character and their picture with a description of what they did. But here it's kind of implied of what happens. And if you've read the books, you kind of in the appendices, you kind of know, like, Éomer becomes the king of Rohan. You know, we didn't talk about Faramir and Éowyn, their relationship developing in the Houses of Healing, which is more fleshed out in the book. So,
And he becomes a prince down south.
Yes. And then they get married and have a child. And then the hobbits, Legolas and Gimli eventually and go, you know, later in life, they go out to the Undying Lands, and then the hobbits go back to the Shire that's unscoured. So before we wrap up, I was just going to ask, do you think the scouring of the Shire, like I would have been on board for the 10-hour cut of this movie. that I would have fully make it Peter Jackson, but if they, do you think that was missing here in terms of, like, do you miss that they didn't include it, or do you think I think it was okay that they didn't. We kind of got a hint of it, I think, in Fellowship when Frodo has a vision.
That's true.
Yeah.
I mean, what could have happened if they hadn't? Well, the way they set it up, that's what could have what could happen if they didn't do this. And so in the films, because they accomplished their goal for them to go back to the Shire and for it to be scourged would have not made sense. I think personally, I'm glad they didn't show it, only because there were so many like endings after ending after ending in this movie. Like, they could have ended at the Black Gates. They could have ended with Frodo and Sam getting picked up by the Eagles. They could have ended with the crowning of Aragorn.
I loved all these endings.
I did too, but I think
adding a scouring would be.
I would have been exhausted. I mean, I would. Having said that, it would be really cool to see a separate film of the scouring of the Shire.
Because there's so much great stuff there. You know,
there is, and even Lobelia Brandybuck redeeming herself. Sackville Baggins. Yeah, sorry, Sackville Baggins. What did I? Brandybuck. Oh my gosh, Bracegirdle. Whatever.
Right, because her maiden name was Bracegirdle. That's right. Why. Yeah.
I saw an old Victorian sign when I was in Chester once, and it was by so and so Bracegirdle and Sons, and I thought, that was a made up name.
Some real name. Bracegirdle from Hardbottle. You know.
Yes, exactly.
I like when they come back to the Shire. In the movie, they circle around to something that was at the very beginning of the Fellowship movie, where there's the guy sweeping his porch, he gives Gandalf a dirty look, and when they come back, he's still giving them a dirty look.
I know, and the guy with his big old pumpkin, like he's polishing his pumpkin in the pub.
I love the pub scene where they're all, you know, they don't really even say anything; they're just they kind of raise a cheers to their shared journey and experiences.
They're four veterans back from the war, basically.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Of course, when they come into the Shire, how they're looking all grand and, you know, Pippin and Merry are just so tall and handsome. And how Frodo kind of nods and winks a little bit like, we've had an interesting adventure. Yeah. And then it fast forwards many years. You know, it's been 5 years since the wound at Weathertop. You know, and that could have been the end. And I have to say this, we could talk about this. Clearly, we could talk about this film for a long time. But when they go to the Grey Havens, you see Celeborn. Mm-hmm. Is it Celeborn? No, not Celeborn. Who is the shipwright?
Curdon.
Caradon, thank you. Caradon,
the
shipwright, yes.
I think there's some background that you kind of see in.
Yeah.
Oh.
He's a really old, old, old elf. And when they all get on the ship, he's gone. So he's like, this is the last one. I'm really getting on this ship now.
For real this time, guys. Yes.
In the book, he stayed on for a long time. In the books, he was really the last one to leave, the last elf to leave Middle Earth.
And he literally, And so I love that little addition. Yeah, go back just to the very end. You can see he's just in the background.
Does he have a beard?
He doesn't. See, that's the thing. Or maybe he does, but I couldn't tell on my television. I don't think he had a beard. Yeah. If he'd had a beard, that would have been like, that's definitely Curdon. But that's got to be Curdon. Who else would it be?
But I love this ending. You know, this final ending of seeing them, seeing the five get on the ship to leave Middle Earth, and it's sad, but you know, they're going to a better place. And then Sam goes home, and that's how it ends.
I'm back.
And I love the final song that plays over the credits. It's a great song, but this singer I found on YouTube, Peter Hollins. He does a lot of covers of acapella things, and he like does all the parts himself. But he does one of the I think the song is The Grey Havens, or I'm not sure what the title is, but it's a great version of that song, and I just love that so much. So that's about all that I have. Anything else you want to say on this film or the trilogy of films before we close out?
Don't try to remake it, Hollywood. No. Please.
No.
Unless it's completely animated in a very beautiful animated style.
Yeah,
I don't want to see a live action remake.
No,
I just don't.
Because there's no, like, they're only, you can't replace any of these characters. I agree. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, my favorite ending, it's like the perfect ending to any book or film. Well, I'm back.
I'm back. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's so Sam, isn't it? He's just, I just did all this stuff, but I'm back.
Yeah. And then you can, in the book, at least you can open up the appendices and you can read about the rest of their lives. The rest of the fellowship, you know, Frodo and Gandalf are gone, but the rest of the fellowship is still in Middle Earth for, you know, and some of them die, like Aragorn and Merry and Pippin all pass away. Legolas and Gimli eventually go to the Undying Lands, or it's said that Gimli goes to the Undying Lands. And then course, Sam eventually goes as well, because he was a ring bearer for that brief time between when Frodo was taken.
Can I mention one thing?
Oh, yeah.
In the film, and this was a big change. This is a major change. Sam never puts the ring on. He just is just wearing it around his neck. He never wears it.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So I just realized that today when I was watching it. That's a big change.
Okay. I forgot he wore it in the book.
He put it on when he heard the orcs coming to collect Frodo. This was in the Two Towers in the book.
Yeah.
And he was following them and he found he could understand what they were saying. And it, you know, Tolkien says he didn't know, Sam didn't know if the ring gave him the ability to understand orc speech or simply understanding. And he slips in.
Okay. Yeah. I guess it just works differently in the films, because it seems like if they, especially that close to Mordor, if you put the ring on, like, Sauron's going to know where you are. Yeah. So I guess it works, you know, somewhat differently in the, or a little bit differently there.
Yeah. But we'll forgive him. It was, the film was okay.
Yeah. It was all right.
Yeah. Might watch it again. Tonight, no.
One of the greatest, like, trilogy finales that's ever been put to screen.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Beautifully done. Beautifully, beautifully done.
Yeah. And Thomas, anything else from you before we...
Nope. I think that's it.
Well, that's it for this episode of The Secrets of Middle Earth. We'd like to take a moment to thank our patrons who make this show possible, including Peter R., Peter D., Ivan I., Father Carl W., and Diane S. Their generous donations help us to continue to create The Secrets of Middle Earth and all the shows at StarQuest. And you can join them at sqpn.com/give. Now, we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. What do you think about Return of the King? Is it less than half of what you hoped for? I had to throw that line in there. I love that. I use that GIF all the time. Please let us know on our Facebook page or on Twitter, or by sending an email to middleearth@sqpn.com. by leaving us a comment on YouTube, or by visiting our channel on the StarQuest Discord community at sqpn.com/discord. So join us next time for continuing discussions of Silmarillion. And until then, thank you, Alex Murray, for joining and sharing the secrets of Middle Earth.
Thank you, Jeff. I really enjoyed it.
And Thomas Lerner, thank you as well.
Thank you, Jeff, and Namarie.
And once again, I'm Jeff Hecker. Thank you for listening to The Secrets of Middle Earth on StarQuest.
Here's another show on the StarQuest Network you're sure to enjoy, The Secrets of Star Wars. Find it wherever fine podcasts are found or at sqpn.com/StarWars.